This is the Monday Morning Quarterback Podcast with Andy Benoit and your host, John Engel.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the MMQB Podcast with Andy Benoit. I'm John Engel at Engel's Engel on Twitter. You can follow Andy at Andy_Benoit. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Get it every Tuesday morning when it comes out. Andy, this week we'll be joined once again by Greg Cosell from NFL Films to talk about the offensive linemen in this year's draft class and our weekly chat with Robert Klemko. We're going to be talking about pro days.
Yeah, and I think we'll make those chats a little longer than usual because, and this is probably not how they teach you to sell something in in communication school, but this is probably the weakest probably the weakest A block we've had of news around the NFL. Just wasn't a lot of news this week, right?
Not much.
I mean, I am not at all excited about the items we're about to talk about right now. Not these. I'm excited for Cosell.
Yeah,
and
don't
even
worry,
though it's only pro days, I'm excited for Klemko because that'll turn into something good.
It gets better. It will get
better. That's what we're promising then.
Yeah, there are some things we got to hit
on. We have NFC
South.
Yeah,
today. We'll break down
the
NFC South there at the end. And have you been immersed in March Madness? It's now coming to a close. I'm sure you had your bracket.
A little bit. And I know as we're recording this, the championship game's getting tipped off.
And
thank you for that because I forgot. I got it on my DVR at home. I've been a little – when I say a little bit, I ignored it until the Final Four this weekend, which I watched with my cousin.
Were you entertained?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, was entertained. We watched it live, and you know how I feel about that. But other than that, it was fine. So one thing people forget about college basketball is same.
Well, you've already ruined baseball for our listeners. Why don't you take down college basketball?
Baseball, I mean, very – yeah, I don't want – I'm not going to say something bad about baseball. It's opening day, too,
yeah,
by
it
the
is
way.
Opening.
Hooray. Something about college basketball, it's the same as college football, where the players are significantly – less talented than the guys in the NBA. But the sport on television, the way it's presented, it happens to look the same. And therefore, we get it. I think it gets kind of crosswired in our brains that, hey, we're looking at some really high-level basketball here. You're looking at some well-performed
18-year-olds.
Yeah, amateur-level basketball. That's what you're looking at. And so I don't get as in it. It became real cheek a few years ago to say I like college, I don't watch the NBA anymore. I'm the total opposite. I want to watch LeBron James.
I agree.
I want to watch the best
superstars.
And when you watch college, all I can think about is, boy, that guy, you know, that guy Okafor might be a pretty good NBA player. I mean, that's all I do is I just watch him.
Not to go on college basketball too much on this, but I noticed in this season, out of all, much different than past seasons, people are upset with the pace of play and the shot clock and stuff.
Well, because it's ridiculous.
But hasn't that always been the case? I've always thought college basketball was slow, and now it's a big, big hot button issue.
What's funny, and I know we'll get to Deshaun Goldson in a minute. Deshaun Goldson coming up, folks. But what's funny is that college basketball, the pace of play, there's a lot of dribbling at the top of the key that takes place. And that is that follows a very fast inbound pass. So a team scores on you, the college team takes the inbound pass and just races up the court, and then they get to half court and it kind of slows down
for 30 seconds
because that gets back to the talent thing. They don't have Dwayne Wade's in there, circa 2006, of course. You don't have the LeBron Jameses. Not very many of them anyway. You don't have them playing all together for sure.
You touched on opening day. Did you see Trey Wingo's tweet?
No.
It said, happy opening day, everybody. Three teams open voluntary workouts in the NFL.
Nice. Yeah.
That's kind of troll-like, but I liked it.
Yeah, it's his job. He runs NFL Live now, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's good at it.
That's like his full only thing he does.
That's it.
It's like his full, yeah. If you move up from SportsCenter anchor, you host a show, that's what you do at ESPN then. You don't often dabble back and forth between the two.
Unless you're Scott Van Pelt. He's everywhere. His radio, SportsCenter.
Yeah. Well, radio's different.
Yeah.
We've kind of both learned on this. You can do this in the seat of your pants, right?
Yeah, we don't plan any of this.
No more trashing ourselves.
Okay, how about Deshaun Goldson? Heading to Washington, didn't work out in Tampa Bay, two seasons there, got big money, and now he's a Redskin. What do you think of the move?
Great move for Washington. They need that because safety was their weakest position last year, as we've seen, and that's a very bad position to be weak at. I don't know if you have to be great at safety, but you cannot be bad at safety, and that was what Washington's issue was. So they get Goldson, who, remember, Scott McLaughlin now, the new GM, was the guy that brought Goldson to San Francisco, and that worked out extremely well. Joe Barry will probably run a similar scheme. It's going to be a 3-4. Joe Barry comes from San Diego. He did coordinate that he's their new D coordinator, of course. He did coordinate a 4-3 defense earlier in his career with the I believe it was the Bucks and the Lions. He was on staffs there, certainly in Detroit. But he's going to run a 3-4 type scheme, which would probably lend to the idea that there will be similar coverages that Goldson saw in San Francisco, because your coverages are often married to your fronts, and they impact one another. And Goldson was very good in San Francisco's 3-4. It sounds weird talking about 3-4 versus 4-3 with the safety. But Goldson, let's think about him now. He's a downhill missile type of a player. He was very similar to Dante Whitner when they were paired together. So if you're a downhill missile type player, then it reasons to believe that you have some form of gap responsibility at times. Maybe not a firm gap responsibility. It differs from play to play, of course. But conceptually, if you're a missile, you're supposed to missile to certain spots on the field. Well, he's going to be more familiar to where he's missling to now. He certainly was not a good fit in Tampa Bay. And what in the hell did the Buccaneers do? Because they went out and they got Goldson, paid him a lot of money, paid Darrelle Revis, one of the top 10 cornerbacks of all time, a lot of money for 1 year. And they drafted Mark Barron, number 6 overall. And then they put all of these guys in the scheme that had nothing to do with their styles of play. Those were man-to-man players they brought in. And Barron's a guy that needs to be playing near the box, needs to be the aggressor. And to have him sit back and zone and read the field is ridiculous. And Goldson obviously wasn't as good at that. And we know there's a lot of waste with Darrelle Revis if you're doing that. That whole approach ought to go down as one of the worst collective efforts of management and coaching of all time.
It's interesting that you say that Goldson was and all of these guys were misused in Tampa, because
I don't say that often, by the way.
No,
because coaches have their reasons, but Lovie Smith's always been a zone coach, and that's what he went and tried to implement there, and that's what they tried to do, and all they did was send millions of dollars out the door and gave up draft picks for it.
Well, my question was going to be, was this a lesson to not spend that kind of money on the downfield missile kind of safety? But if it was a schematic issue, then
I think it was a schematic. Now, look, ultimately the player is responsible for how they perform. And if you're a great player, then you'll find a scheme. You'll work in whatever scheme they put you in.
And Revis wasn't bad.
Right. But if we're talking about guys who are on a scale of 1 to 10 in terms of effectiveness, if we're talking about guys that are 9s and sometimes 9.5s or even 10s, then don't put them in position to be 7s, which is what they would achieve being zone players. So it was just a bad effort. Now both sides have moved on. Tampa Bay, you know, they still paid Goldson as he went out the door, too. They don't have a lot to show for him. And, in fact, I'm looking at their secondary now. Yeah, see, now they've got their safeties are now Chris Conte, Major Wright, Brad McDougald, Keith Tandy, who played in some dime packages. They don't need valuable safeties there, but also they're weak at this position now. This was a bad, bad two-year stretch for the Buccaneers overall. I think the Redskins got a good player.
Buffalo Bills head coach Rex Ryan, back in the news, as he always likes to be, said it's too early to throw the book out on E.J. Manuel after two seasons. 14 starts, 6-8, 16 touchdowns, 12 picks.
Yeah, he's right. He's right. 14, you said it, 14 starts. Now, has Manuel shown the traits that you desire in a starting NFL quarterback? Nah, not really. Not at all, in fact, because his accuracy is not there, certainly not consistently. He moves well, but not frighteningly so. You know, you go into a game plan with the idea of, all right, let's make sure Manuel doesn't beat us with his legs, but you don't go in with the idea like, oh my God, let's hope Manuel doesn't kill us with his legs. Obviously we know Rex Ryan. What else is he going to say this time of year? It does him no harm to say a thing like this, and it does him some harm to say the opposite or to disparage Manuel. It'll be a true quarterback competition there between Castle and EJ Manuel, though.
Yeah, they have Matt Castle. Is EJ Manuel, if compared to Geno Smith, is that an upgrade or a downgrade having EJ Manuel?
Ooh, good question. I think it's a downgrade.
Like Geno Smith more?
Yeah, because Geno Smith moves almost as well as Manuel does, and the movement is really Manuel's greatest attribute, and especially in why I think it could be a genuine competition with Matt Castle here, especially in a run-based offense and with a runner like LeSean McCoy, where you have multi-directional read option opportunities at your disposal now. So that's Manuel's strength, and I think it'd be interesting to see Greg Roman use that this year if he gets on the field, if Manuel can win the competition. But you can also do that with Geno Smith. The thing that Geno has that Manuel does not is a capacity to throw from the pocket. Obviously, Geno Smith's very inconsistent himself, and that's why he's not cemented by any means as an NFL starter now, or it doesn't look like he'll be that in the future. But he is willing to drop back and throw from the pocket, and to me, that suggests there's something to work with there, at least.
They're on the Jets, one of Rex's former pass rushers, defensive
end.
Yeah.
One of a destruction causer, I'd say. Talking about Muhammad Wilkerson.
Is that
right?
How you define Wilkerson?
I would say, and look, at pass rushers, I'm not like trying to like be nitpicky or whatever, but like there's a difference, and I think Wilkerson can be both. I think he's very good at them.
Well, not if he doesn't show up.
Okay, that's what you're getting at, the offseason workouts?
Well, we're doing our around the league. We might as well hit on some
news. All right, yeah, I guess
news.
We don't need to get into a full scouting thing on Muhammad Wilkerson. We know what he is.
He's
very
good.
Long-armed and explosive, and that makes him a pass rusher, but I think overall his job is to be an ass kicker there because he'll take on the blocks as much as he will beat the blocks.
It's interesting. So you have any thoughts on him missing voluntary workouts?
I think he's negotiating for a new contract, and it's in his best interest to do that because you don't want to get hurt at those workouts. You have services that you try to get paid for in the NFL. You don't want to give those away. This is what you're supposed to do. It's just a business thing. The Jets, there's no way the Jets are taking this personally by any means.
LeSean McCoy is not afraid of talking about Chip Kelly, saying he doesn't like star players.
That's what McCoy said, Kelly said. Now we're getting into it. When's Cosell coming up?
Soon.
I mean, we care about what LeSean McCoy.
Count to 30 and Greg Cosell will be on. Wrap this up.
LeSean McCoy knows Chip Kelly better than I do. He's probably exactly right because Kelly hasn't shown he needs star players. So I don't know what context McCoy was saying this in. I could read the quote, but I don't know what his tone was like, anything like that. To me, it's a non-story. But isn't it weird that every week now we have a LeSean McCoy? We're all sitting around waiting for LeSean McCoy to bomb Chip Kelly here. And at some point, it will happen. He'll say something in the word, and this is almost it, but not quite it. At some point, McCoy will say something where the words can get twisted just ever so slightly in the right way, where he's going to be ripping Chip Kelly now. Because he's getting asked about this, and it's becoming a story every single week, it seems like.
Greg Cosell is now here to join us and to save you, I guess, from ourselves? Or from NFL offseason?
We're at that point of the NFL offseason. We're at the point where we're waiting for the draft to happen. This is what happens when you put the draft so far back. We got another month of this. So subscribe on iTunes, people. I don't know why I just did that. Yeah.
Why would you do that? That's terrible.
So we got Greg, though.
All right, Greg, a good group of offensive linemen across the board in this draft from what we hear. And when it comes to the offensive tackles, Brandon Scherff from Iowa is described as somewhat of the most pro-ready guy. What exactly does that mean for our listeners when you look at a guy and you say he's the most pro-ready?
Well, I think he's like all Iowa left tackles, is that he's fundamentally repetitive. So in that sense, he does the same thing on almost every play. I wouldn't call him a great athlete. I would say that his MO is consistent execution. He's probably more powerful than athletically explosive. But my guess is he'll probably play left tackle in the NFL, although you never know with these Iowa left tackles. You see Brian Bulaga plays right tackle for Green Bay. Riley Reiff plays left tackle for Detroit. So Scherff is a guy that could actually line up in different spots, but my guess is he will play left tackle.
And, Greg, a guy from Iowa that was also left tackle and moved to guard years ago, Robert Gallery, who could be in the discussion. Would Scherff, is it possible? I mean, a lot of people are projecting him to move to guard and go down that path. And when I clicked on him today, initial thought was he looks like a guard. I don't know how long his arms are or what his measurables are, but what are your thoughts on moving him to guard, if that's a good idea and what that would entail?
Well, you know, it's funny because to me, there are some similarities between Scherff and when Jake Long came out of Michigan. And at the time when Long came out of Michigan and he was the number one pick in the draft, there was a lot of talk that his better position would be right tackle. And with Scherff, my sense is people will think that way. And I would bet that people will think he'd be a dominant all-pro type left guard because he's much more of a road grading type player than truly an athletic type dancing bear. He's not that kind of left tackle, which gets into a larger discussion about left tackle versus right tackle, and I think that delineation is not as sharp for coaches in the league as it might be for media and fans.
Greg, when we talk about offensive linemen, the conversation always seems to circle back around to footwork, and Lyle Collins from LSU is known for that, the quick feet and the mobility. Where does footwork rank in your evaluation of offensive linemen?
Well, look, I mean, everybody would like certainly the tackle position where you work on an island more than any other offensive line position. You would like the tackle, particularly the left tackle, for the conventional wisdom, to be very athletic, to have light, quick feet, to be that dancing bear. So you do look for that. But I think you then have to step back and realize that not every left tackle in the NFL is that guy. And there's a lot of people who play left tackle in the NFL, Andrew Whitworth for Cincinnati, an above-average left tackle, who are not those kinds of players. So you have to sort of step back and realize that a lot of these guys will start in the league and play left tackle. You mentioned Collins. Collins is really a road grader. I mean, he's a terrific run blocker. He may be the best run-blocking left tackle in this draft. Now, he's athletic enough to be to pass protect really well too, but he needs some work in that area. He's a little top heavy in lunges at times, but I think he's got the overall athletic and movement traits to play left tackle with coaching and refinement.
Andres Pete from Stanford is the first underclassman we'll talk about. What impresses you about him, Greg?
Well, I actually think that Pete, as we speak today, is the best overall left tackle prospect in this draft class. He's got a tremendous combination of size and movement with his kind of run-blocking and pass-protecting paradigm. I would say that he's a guy that's, when it comes to the kind of player he is, he's more of a power left tackle than a finesse movement athletic left tackle. But because he's so big and he does move well, he certainly can line up and play left tackle in the NFL. I think he could line up and play left tackle in the NFL as a rookie.
Wow, and how? So give us some perspective then. Who's your number two tackle right now, and how big is the gap between him and Pete?
Well, it's not so much who my number two is. I actually think that the best natural athlete of the left tackle prospects in this class is DJ Humphreys from Florida. He has an outstanding combination of traits as both a run blocker and a pass protector, and I think overall, as you look down the road, because I mentioned Pete today is the best guy, I think that Humphreys could be the best left tackle coming out of this draft when you go 2-3 years down the road. He's really an athletic, smooth mover, and he's pretty nasty as well. He's a very good run blocker. He matched up against Shane Ray, for instance, from Missouri. Humphreys competed throughout the game. He was not the least bit out-athleted against Shane Ray. So, Humphreys is a really interesting prospect.
Injuries the last two seasons there for Humphreys in Florida, does that concern you at all?
You're always concerned about it. I don't know what to make of that, John. I never do when guys have injuries. I guess for some, they'll view it as a red flag. I'm just trying to evaluate the player.
Sure.
And assuming that he won't be injured. So I don't really know how to factor that in, but I think he's the best left tackle prospect in the draft.
Sticking there in Florida, this works nicely, a nice little transition. Eric Flowers out of Miami, what are your thoughts on him?
Yeah, now there's a guy who I think is a guard, to be honest with you. And I think ultimately Eric Flowers, he reminded me of Orlando Franklin when Franklin came out of Miami. Franklin transitioned to offensive guard in the NFL ultimately and is a pretty good offensive guard. I think that Flowers is a guy that brings attitude, toughness. He's competitive. He's powerful. I don't think he's very quick-footed. I mean, he's got functional feet, but he's not particularly quick-footed. I don't think he has the desirable movement traits you ultimately look for to be a starting tackle in the NFL. And he had a couple of sort of watershed games that, you know, if you're evaluating him, are a little troublesome. He couldn't block Randy Gregory from Nebraska, and he had a hard time with Virginia's Eli Harold, who's probably a top 40 or top 50 pick in this draft, and not a great pass rusher, by the way. But Flowers really had problems with both players.
With Pittsburgh's TJ Clemmings, he's said to look the part by a lot of people as an offensive tackle. Explain what that means for our listeners and me, basically, for people that don't know what look the part means from a NFL left tackle.
Ultimately, you have to see the guy to really make that statement. And what you see is a guy that has light, active feet. You can see the athletic movement. He's got excellent balance and body control. He's only played tackle for 2 years. He went to Pittsburgh as a defensive lineman. So right now you see a guy that's a little robotic and mechanical in his reactions, but you can easily see the light, easy movement. He's a guy who's played right tackle for 2 years. I would bet he'll eventually transition to left tackle. The player who you might think of that's presently in the NFL might be Tyron Smith, the left tackle for the Dallas Cowboys, who came out of USC very young, played right tackle for a year, and then moved to left tackle. I think Clemmons might be that kind of guy.
As a style or as what he's capable of?
Well, just the athleticism. You know, again, I don't know if he'll become that good a player, but I think he has the athletic movement to make that kind of transition.
Is Jake Fisher out of Oregon also one of those technical guys you've looked at, Greg?
Yeah, he's he needs one thing to keep in mind, guys. Almost all offensive linemen, particularly tackles, all need work with their hands. Very few tackles come out of college into the NFL and use their hands well. Fisher fits into that category. His hand placement is really low, and he tends to fire too late. He's a more mechanical pass protector. I think he's more athletic as a run blocker. I think he's a little stiffer as a pass protector. To me, he's kind of a lowercase Jake Matthews type player, which obviously sounds like a real positive, and it is. He just doesn't quite move as well as Matthews, but I think with Fisher, you pretty much know what you're going to get. He's a consistent player. I think that he's a very effective run blocking, and he's competitive. And, you know, one thing I've learned over the years is watching offensive linemen, and it took me a while to really understand this, is you really want to look at their competitiveness and their tenacity, because it's very hard on every play to look perfect. And ultimately, you want guys that compete and they battle. And that's how they recover at times, because they might get beat initially, but how do they respond?
There's always so much focus on the Oregon system, especially this year with Marcus Mariota and skill position players, and what's the system mean and how does it translate?
Right.
How do they translate? I would assume that's got to be true for offensive linemen too. Is it hard to get a good, clear picture on a guy like Jake Fisher?
Sometimes with offensive linemen, because you don't see them necessarily pass protect on deeper drops, as they will have to do at times in the NFL. So you try to figure out, based on your evaluation of his feet, his movement, is he tight in his lateral movement? Is he tight in his pass set? You try to get a sense of those kinds of things. But that's a great question, Andy, because so many of these offenses in college, the ball comes out quick. And guys do not really pass protect the way they will have to do it in the NFL. So you have to project and transition, and that makes it a little more difficult. So someone like Fisher is a perfect example of that. He's a little stiff in his core in pass protection. So now you have to decide, okay, what does that mean? Does that mean he can't play tackle? Does that mean he's a better guard prospect? It might be the case. He's a player I bet some teams will look at and say he's an offensive guard.
Greg, moving on to the guards, A.J. Cann from South Carolina looks to be that first guard off the board in this draft. Do you agree with that?
He's just a really solid, efficient player. He's one of those guys that I think he may not be an all-pro for 10 years, but he's going to be a starter for 10 years. He's got the desirable combination of athletic movement and power and leverage that you look for at the guard position. So he's a guy that I think that's, like I said, you can pretty much, I think he's a plug-and-play guy. He'll start as a rookie, in my opinion, and he could likely play for a long time.
How about Laken Tomlinson? He started 52 straight games at Duke. Do you see that consistency translating to the NFL quickly?
You know, he's an interesting player, John, because he's not really an athletic player, but he's a guy who's really competitive and plays with an edge. And the thing that you really like if you're an O-line coach is he didn't mind pissing people off, pissing off defensive linemen. He was that kind of player. You wouldn't call him athletic. He's not a smooth and rangy athlete. He's not that kind of guy. But, I mean, he's a tempo setter. But you still have to look at what might be some weaknesses in his game. Will he struggle with interior quickness? You know, will three technique types, you know, the Gerald McCoys of the world, will those guys give him trouble? Because he's not a real athletic guy. What he is he's a powerful man. He played a strong man's game with a high degree of competitiveness and tenacity. And one thing I've learned over the years, that almost always translates well for a starting offensive guard in the NFL.
Would it be fair to say that a guy like Tomlinson then translates or would transfer better to a more younger offensive line almost, where he's got talent around him, a good, talented young offensive line, but one that's not necessarily known for attitude versus just being a cog in a five-man front?
Well, my sense is, Andy, he would fit better in what we call gap scheme concepts, you know, power,
yeah,
corner, not zone concepts where you have to really move and have light feet. I don't think he fits zone schemes real well. So I think that he's more of a scheme-specific offensive guard and therefore a team-specific offensive guard. I don't think he's a zone guard.
We'll wrap up this running through some centers here, Greg, with Cameron Irving from Florida State being the only guy I'm really seeing with a first-round grade. What makes him the head of this group?
Yeah, and I haven't seen enough of him, John, at the center position, so because he played left tackle for, oh, God, the last 3 years. And, you know, he moved inside to center, and he seems to be on everyone's list, and I just haven't seen enough of him just yet. The guy I really like that I have seen a lot of is the Oregon kid, Ronis Grasu. And he's, you know, it's funny. Sometimes with interior offensive linemen, you have to watch a lot of games because I'm trying to figure out the best way to say this, but, you know, sometimes you can watch centers or guards, and because they don't necessarily look smooth like tackles sometimes do, it's hard to get a feel for them until you watch, and Grasu is that kind of player. He's rarely on the ground, and think about that. You know, to be rarely on the ground for an interior offensive lineman is really impressive. He played with great balance, great awareness. He consistently executed snap after snap. He's very competitive. And, you know, keep this in mind. He played on a team that didn't huddle and that played at a fast break tempo, and he never looked like he was tired.
When we talk about these Oregon linemen, I think it's easy to kind of picture a Max Unger type who's built more around athleticism than sheer power. Can power, like we've talked about how arm strength can increase with some guys in the NFL, not many, but some. Can that be true of power for offensive linemen in the NFL?
Yeah, because I think pretty much most scouts would tell you this, Andy. You can make guys stronger. You can't make guys more athletic.
Right.
And because you can, you know, once, keep in mind, all these guys are going to go into NFL weight rooms, and assuming they're good workers, they're going to get stronger. But you can't make a guy an explosive mover if he's not an explosive mover. So I think that your question is 100% right. You can get guys stronger, and that's part of the evaluation process. We've probably talked about, I know you and I have talked about this, Andy. I don't know if we talked about it on the podcast. One of the toughest things for me that I've talked to coaches about and I've tried to learn myself when it comes to offensive linemen is what can be coached and what can't be coached. Because when you have to understand at times that there are certain things that you can coach. I've spoken to offensive line coaches about guys and they'll say, oh, I can fix that in 2 weeks. And other times there's things that you can't fix. So you try to get a feel for what you can coach and what you can't coach.
Hey, Greg, I'm thinking about what you said about Grasu and or I guess you said it during Grasu, but it wasn't about him specifically, but how you have to watch more games for offensive linemen. And I'm wondering why that would be the case. Do you think it's because they cover less ground in their action than everybody?
And because of the nature of their position, where they're surrounded by a lot of bodies, they don't necessarily look smooth and comfortable. You know, it's not a playing guard and center is not pretty. You know, it's not like, let's say, watching, you know, I remember watching Joe Thomas, the left tackle now with the Browns, when he came out of Wisconsin, Andy, and you could just see, oh, that guy, he had a pretty kick slide. You know, he's working on an island, and you just look at his movement, and you go, wow, that's really pretty movement, and you know that the guy's going to be a really good left tackle. Centers and guards work in a phone booth with a lot of people around, and they rarely look pretty. So you have to watch a lot of games to see how they handle situations where, you know, there's a lot of bodies bumping into each other, where, you know, don't forget, the defense moves when the ball gets snapped.
Well, that is true. That's a good point.
You know, that's the way it works. So sometimes these guys have to make adjustments in a very small area, and, you know, it takes a lot of games at times to really see how they handle that. And that's why I thought it was so impressive with Grasso that he wasn't on the ground very much.
Hey, Greg, Grasso's actually quite a bit smaller than Irving, too, from what I'm seeing. Does that give him an advantage in balance that you've noticed?
Well, you know, again, Oregon is a team that runs predominantly, not 100%, but predominantly a zone scheme where size is not considered as important. Movement is far more important. And my guess is he'll be seen that way as he transitions to the NFL. You know, what's really impressive about him, and not that this means a ton, but he started every game he played at Oregon, which is, you know, just think about that. And again, that doesn't automatically mean he's a good pro center, but he's a four-year starter. And there are very few of those guys in college football.
Especially the center position, I would imagine.
Yeah, I would think so. I almost feel like center is like a catcher in baseball, you know?
Yes, yeah, that's a great way to say that. Let's talk about offensive line. Just, I mean, we've kind of gone through the prospects, or I'm sure there are more, but is there anyone we're forgetting first, Greg?
Well, there's always, you know, guys that I like that we, you know, haven't been talked about. I mean, so, and again, it's just my opinion. I think at tackle, there's a guy I really like from Wisconsin who's a right tackle, and I think he's going to be a 10-year starter in the league, and his name is Rob Havenstein. And I think he's your classic right tackle. I think he's a better prospect than when Ricky Wagner came out of Wisconsin, and he's a starting right tackle in the league. So that's one guy I really like. And then there's a guard, and I know that not many people know this name, but, you know, Andy, you know this is the kind of stuff I do. There's a guard from West Virginia named Mark Glowinski, who I think is another guy that could be a 10-year starter in the league.
From a conceptual standpoint, so here was my theory that I came up with on offensive linemen about this time last year, maybe 2 years ago. But and the Cowboys have kind of punctured some holes in it lately, so I might have to reevaluate. No, I'm serious. I mean, the Cowboys, here's the theory, and you'll understand what I mean. I don't think you need good or certainly not great, i.e. expensive, offensive linemen. The goal of the offensive line is you just can't have a bad one at the position. Because the nature of the position, the way it's played, you're not creating anything from a lineman. You're only preventing something. And the result of a very average pass block is often identical or very close to the same as a result of a good pass block from any of the positions. It gets the job done, so to speak. Agree or disagree with that, Greg?
I think that's perhaps more true in the pass game and can also then be a function of your quarterback. I think in the run game, it's a little different. Not that you need five all-pros to have a good running game, but I think the running game is a little... First of all, I think the running game requires an awful lot of coordination with your linemen, depending on your scheme, but almost all schemes require coordination with your five offensive linemen and perhaps a tight end and if there's a fullback involved. So I think your point is more valid in the passing game, but I think the quarterback helps that. I'm not sure it's as valid in the run game.
You mentioned that you kind of casually said Scherff could maybe be an all-pro left guard, or I think you said there are people that believe he could be an all-pro left guard, and then we go back to talking about him as a tackle. To me, I don't understand why we don't stop right there and say, hey, let's make him a left guard then. Because if you ask the Ravens, how important is Marshall Yanda at right guard?
Right.
Or the Niners a few years ago, how important was Mike Iupati at left guard for you? Or the Cowboys with Larry Allen to go way back. They tell you we probably wouldn't have won as many games if we didn't have them, or we certainly would have done as we'd not have done as many different things in our running game if we didn't have them. So why don't we just make these guys that could be all pro left guards? Okay, let's make them a guard then.
Which is a great question, and I think there's a sense that tackle, particularly left tackle, which is the conventional wisdom, is the most important position on the offensive line. And whether that's true or not, I think you could make an argument that it's not necessarily true, although that's always thrown out there. Now, most coaches, when they put together pass protection concepts, they will slide the protection to one side or the other. You can slide the protection to the left. You can slide the protection to the right. The left tackle, just by gospel now these days, has mm-hmm. become the most important position, but it's not necessarily that way. So everybody looks for someone to be a left tackle.
Greg, I agree with you 100%. I think what happened, if you know, 10 years ago, maybe a little less than that, but Michael Lewis wrote The Blind Side, and
yep.
it became very trendy to be the smart guy in the room and say, hey, I like the left tackle, even though he doesn't touch the ball because he's, you know, he protects the quarterback. But and the evidence that Michael Lewis, who did a great job with that book, the evidence that he cited to was, I forget who the Niners, you might remember, who the Niners had blocking, but it was Lawrence Taylor feasted on their left tackle. And that's where it dawned on Bill Walsh or something like that, that the position's important. But we're talking about, and I think what happened was, we're talking about an era of football where there were seven-step dropbacks more, and guys were under center, and they were turning their back
too.
Now, yeah, everything's so much in shotgun now, and the quick release is another thing, but just the formation of shotgun, that alone eliminates some of the blind side element. The quarterback doesn't have his eyes totally off any defensive lineman anymore.
I couldn't agree more. The nature of the passing games in the NFL, with very few exceptions, are not deep drop passing games. And even when teams do what we call shot plays, where they do have deep drops off play action, it's normally on a first and 10 or a normal down and distance situation, and those plays normally have seven-man protection concepts.
Yep.
So the idea that the left tackle is the most important player is a little antiquated right now, and it'll be interesting to see if the league moves in that direction, because that's if you watch enough tape, as we do, that's not the way the game is played right now, but there's still a general perception that left tackle is the most important position on an offensive line. In some ways, with all the interior blitzing now, I've talked to some people who are arguing that the center is becoming the more important position.
And I would argue that the most important position is whatever your worst one is, because that's where the blitz designs will head towards when Sunday rolls around. Defensive coordinators see this tape better than we do, Greg. And
yep.
and their job's to exploit what you do worst. And I would think your most important one is the one you have to account for most, so to speak.
That's right. Make the weak link play.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what coaching is. And you're exactly right. So, you know, this idea about the left tackle, we'll see how it plays out. I mean, if Brandon Scherff is, and again, I don't know how people feel about him, but I'm just giving you my opinion. But if people ultimately share my opinion and think that he could be a dominant guard, then your point's well taken. Why not just put him at guard and you have an all-pro guard?
I love this because offensive line play and evaluating offensive linemen is the last on things to do for even hardcore football fans or Cosell disciples. I mean, this is the
well,
last place
me,
you
stop. Well, believe me, it's taken me a lot of years to talking to a lot of people, and there are times when I'm watching, John, where sometimes five, six plays go by, and I start talking to myself and thinking, God, am I really evaluating this guy properly? And then I have some friends who are former offensive linemen who come to films on occasion, and I'll show them some things, and it turns out they agree with me. So then I think, okay, I guess maybe once in a while I get one right. But offensive line is tough to analyze in the college game and transition it to the NFL game.
Well, and that's why we have you, and that we don't try to do it ourselves, Andy.
Yeah, no, Greg, you save us a lot of time, as always, here.
Well, I try. I mean, hey, we'll see how it plays out, but the guy I'm most anxious to see is that DJ Humphries from Florida, because I think athletically, and that's not the only thing, but I think athletically he's the best in this group.
Well, thanks, Greg. We'll do pass rushers next week. If you're right, I assume you've got.
Oh, I'll be ready to do pass rushers for sure.
Yeah,
that's great. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, guys.
One more quick news item, Andy, before we get to Robert Klemko, who will jump on with us. Crabtree doesn't look to be a Niner anymore. Now talking with the Oakland Raiders. What do you think of that?
He's been talking with teams and hanging around on the market, and I guess he's wanting to get the best offer he can. He's waiting for the right offer. Usually that means the right offer is not going to come when you're this late in the offseason. Now, it can. I remember 1 year Charles Woodson scored a huge contract from Green Bay really late in the offseason like this in April. But that's all I can remember. There maybe have been more, but more often than not, guys like Crabtree at this stage of free agency are going to take a one-year deal and play it out for $3.5 million, $4 million, which I think that's what he was talking about with Oakland, wasn't it?
I think so, yeah.
And there were talks, wasn't it Miami he had talked with, something like that? There were other teams, and he's a good player. That's what I find a little surprising about this, because Crabtree is not quite what we thought he'd be coming out of Texas A&M, but he is
Texas Tech.
Yeah, Texas. I knew it was wrong when I said
right,
but I couldn't.
It?
I was then I went through the Oklahoma schools and I thought, where am I now?
You're a computer processor.
Yeah, Texas Tech. He didn't. You know, he came out with a lot of hype, and that was partly because he had some celebrities pumping him up. I think he was tight with some guys, but
cover of video games and
yeah. He's still a very good possession target, an excellent number two, so to speak. I think he runs the whole route tree. I like Michael Crabtree a lot. In fact, I would say he's one of the best pure route runners in the NFL.
So now he's not a number one anymore to you? Was he ever really a number one? Or was he just put into that role?
I think he can do number one things. Again, it depends what you mean by number one. To me, there aren't more than maybe 12 true number ones in the NFL.
Interesting.
Because it's a guy that gets safety help on a regular basis. Crabtree isn't going to command that kind of thing. But that Niners offense was a lot better. The better he played, the better that Niners offense functioned at times. Not always, but often. And that means something. I think that, and we're talking about a guy who's a great route runner who also has some of the best hands in the league. If your hands are great and your route running's great, chances are you're going to be a pretty good wide receiver.
That's true, yeah. Well, let's move on to Robert Klemko now.
Yeah, sounds good.
Hey, Robert, you were at your alma mater this week, right? Maryland?
Yep, University of Maryland College Park.
And that was for the Pro Day there, and you got to talk to some coaches about how they value Pro Day or what they do at Pro Day. Explain that a little bit.
Well, the idea was to pick one of these Pro Days and do an anatomy of a Pro Day and kind of explain to the fan who doesn't go to these things, what they entail and what teams get out of them outside of what you now see on NFL Network, which seems to shape so many people's perception of the entire offseason.
And I'm glad when John sent me, he sent me kind of an outline of what we were going to talk about with you today, and I saw Maryland Pro Day, and I thought there's no way that's what the editors are running for justice. Like, it can't be about just the Maryland Pro. There has to be a conceptual thing behind it. So I'm glad to hear that it's more of a holistic examination of Pro Days rather than telling us who
the prospects.
I don't know the Maryland. I mean, who are the Maryland prospects? Are there any?
Well, it would make a little bit more sense from a Maryland angle if Stephon Diggs had the season that he had as a sophomore, because I think he would have been a first round pick and then a guy we'd have written about extensively.
Hey, Robert, did you ever know what years were you at Maryland?
I was there from 07 to 2010 was when I graduated.
Okay. So it's probably going to be, it's certainly, this was before your time, but I would hope you know who I'm talking about. Do you know who Eric Abagu is?
Eric Abagu.
I bet you've seen him around campus. He's the We Must Protect This House guy.
No way.
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay. That's the actor.
Well, no, but he was also an NFL player. He was the Cowboys defensive lineman for like 2 years or something like that.
Okay, I didn't know that.
You would know that.
Did you ever? Yeah, I remember seeing him on the field, thinking, "God, that's the protecting the house guy." And then I looked it up, and it was.
Andy, why would you hope that I know that? That's such an obscure thing to know.
No, because he's a Maryland icon. I would think he's around campus.
He's not a Maryland icon. Like, what are you talking about?
Based on the film study, Andy, did he in fact protect that house?
No, he couldn't get after the other house either. He tried to rush the passer. I actually saw him recently. I saw him at Mobile for the Senior Bowl. And
doing
he,
what?
He was really griping about something. I don't want to throw him out there, but he's still a star based on his behavior at Mobile. He had people around him trying to calm. You know, he wasn't dangerous, but he was throwing a little like famous guy fit. You know,
I really want to hear that whole story. What is it with the podcast and just teasing people with half stories?
That's true. You do tend to do that. I'm not going to say who it was, but I talked to a coach and he bought a beer and then he got really.
The whole story was. He was griping about, I can't remember what, someone had done something minor to him.
I think they've moved on from that advertising campaign, so this is
but
free
no,
reign.
He's still standing there with Under Armour guys, and he has different shoe boxes with him of different Under Armour stuff, and he has all the gear on. He clearly works for him somehow still. And he's griping about how, you know, like, I'm the kind of guy that doesn't like it when someone does something like this to me, you know, kind of the little righteous, you know, pontification and all that stuff.
Right, right.
I walked all the way around the field, and at the Senior Bowl, that takes some time, not because the field's big, but because you stop and see people, you kind of stop and just stare off for a while, try to figure out what to do while they practice.
Because you're the bell of the ball down there.
That's exactly what, yeah, that's it. I'm the bell. I'm just a guy that's like gawking at Rex Ryan from 30 yards away.
With his fanny pack and his binoculars.
Yeah, but anyway, I got all the way around the field and back to where Abago was standing, which was under the goalposts, and you wouldn't be able to tell that I had left the conversation. You know what I'm saying? Like he was in the
still gone.
He was in the middle of the same trough, just whining away at it. And I thought this guy is still somebody because those people are standing around him still. And you've never seen him, Robert. You never saw him around campus.
No, he was not around campus at all. I think I'd notice a dude that huge just walking around.
He's
and screaming about shoes and different shirts.
He's got to be one of the 10 most notable Terps of all time. No, I'm serious.
Oh, my God. I can't believe you just said that.
Right,
Andy.
Up there with Robert Klemko, Scott Van Pelt.
Yeah, yeah.
I can name 10 more notable guys just who played basketball at Maryland than this guy.
Excusing athletes. Let's say excusing athletes, except for like.
Except
like,
for him, he was an athlete.
No, except yeah, but he wasn't. That's not what I'm talking. He was a beacon of the university because all that Under Armour stuff comes from Maryland, right? I mean, that's where it all originated.
Yeah, but it was invented by a Maryland grad. I mean, that guy's way more famous than whoever modeled that.
Oh,
stuff.
Is he really? What's his name?
Kevin Plank is his name, Andy.
All right.
Oh, wow.
I wasn't expecting that. I'm Googling it, though.
Andy has this playful tone of condescending.
Oh, you know what's bad? Is I read a whole New Yorker thing on Kevin Plank about a year ago. I just remembered. I even remember the YMCA of equipment I was on, an aerobic machine.
You really are. You're all highbrow now. You read the New Yorker. You don't watch commercials.
That's right. Yeah, here this Kevin Plank is somebody. So he's one of the 10 most famous, but that doesn't mean Eric Abagu's not in the discussion still.
Look, dude, he's honorable mention, maybe number like 15.
All right. I can live with that. So can you maybe
Robert
we,
is
maybe
so
we need
done
to let,
with your crap.
Maybe we need to let him tell us about the pro day stuff and what his article's about.
What you can read on the website, themmqb.com today, or if you just want to hear about it now, because that's easier. I lead the story with the fact that there was only one head coach at the actual pro day, and it was Bill Belichick, and he was wearing a Johns Hopkins pullover hoodie, and he showed up late and through the back door and spent the entire time on the field talking to Randy Edsall. It's the first time I'd seen it in like 8 pro days this season. It's just a coach grabbing the head coach on the field and them talking for 2 hours straight in plain view of everybody. It was pretty unique.
Did anybody have the gall to approach them at any point?
Not a single person. Like, they were on an island, basically. Everyone just kind of staying out of earshot, but, like, stealing glances at them.
Yeah, yeah. Belichick's the only guy left in the league that I think I steal glances at these guys because you know them and they are famous and all that. But you get used to them, especially coaches, because they're at all this stuff that we go to during the offseason. But Belichick's guy I glance at repeatedly still.
Yeah. I think you're right. And I think he still has that aura of being somewhat unapproachable or untouchable or some mix of those two things because of how he is with the media, because he doesn't really let anybody get close.
Yeah.
Like when I think of like who Belichick is, the only image in my mind is him on the boat in that NFL Films thing with his girlfriend in the bikini.
Was that? He was also on a boat with Jimmy Johnson in that same show, wasn't he?
Yeah. They were all on the boat together. But that's the only really personal image I have of him. Everything else is just him dominating at football.
Dude, Larry David went to Maryland.
Okay.
Yeah, Larry David, Jim Henson, Connie Chung. Like, there's so many people. What's wrong with you guys?
I didn't know. Don't lump me in
with Andy and his crazy theories about.
I didn't know some of those names. I didn't know some of those names had gone there. But Robert said top 15. So if Robert's going to say top 15 when I say top 10, that means my top 10's not utterly ridiculous.
Well, I'm just guessing. Like, I'm sure, like, if I pulled my mom, who's been there since 1980, this guy wouldn't even be on her radar, and she could name, like, 30 famous people.
We'll have to bring her on next week.
I mean, I'm thinking about starting my own podcast, and I might just let you guys come on it if you're respectful.
What is this a coup?
What would the name of your podcast be, Robert?
Clem and Stuff.
Ooh.
That's pretty good. It's better than the MMQB podcast with Andy Benoit.
Robert, do you believe in these pro days at all? I went to the USC one. I've been to the Boise State one. Those are the only two. And the Boise State one was my first, and I was younger, so I was enamored with it, and I wanted to believe that everything I was seeing was, like, high level, very well thought out. I went to the USC one, and the coaches almost watched half-heartedly. Like, they're sitting there really chatting with each other. I mean, I chatted with a coach the entire time, a friend of mine. I thought, he's here at this pro day. If I'm valuable enough at this moment to be talked to during throughout the thing, this event must be utterly worthless. Like he's, you know, I know, and I'm not trying to disparage myself. I'm just saying, like, we're shooting the breeze.
Exactly, yeah. I think it's worth it for the teams that really, really do a thorough job of getting in the kids' backstory, because you got to remember, at most of these things, the parents, family members, friends, coaches from high school are there and permitted to watch. And I was talking with actually Kevin Colbert of the Steelers, and he was saying that Mike Tomlin is like this master behind the scenes at pro days. Like, he'll sneak off and nobody will see him, but he's off with, you know, the top prospect's mom, getting all of her information so he can interview her later. Tomlin has been coming in before pro days and taking prospects out to dinner like the night before, and no other head coach is really doing that we've heard of. So I think different people take advantage of it in different ways.
You talk to Kevin Colbert. See, to me, he's kind of one of those Belichick unapproachable guys. He walks around Indy during the combine, and for one, I guess fans don't really know who he is. They don't realize that one of the most powerful people in the NFL, decision makers, just walked by them.
He's probably the most underrated name or figure in personnel in the league. I'm trying to think of another one.
I used to think that. I used to pound the tables about that. But, you know, I'm looking at some of Pittsburgh's cap situations lately. And right. And also, we have to see how this young defense develops over the years. And right now, I think the jury's out on these Jarvis Jones and Jason Worlds didn't work out. And so,
sure.
And I know Worlds retired, but anyone who listened to the podcast, I didn't think he was ever that great to begin with. But, I get what you're saying, though. He's certainly underappreciated, even if he has slipped, and not that a guy loses his football acumen and just slips all of a sudden. But,
right.
Yeah, I'd agree with you. He's underappreciated in the very least, and maybe the most underappreciated.
Right. Well, yeah, we got him on the phone for the draft column because I wanted to talk to a couple coaches, a couple personnel people, Ravens and Steelers included, about what it's like to draft late in the first round constantly and, like, always feeling like maybe you have that one more piece, maybe you just need that one more piece versus just drafting the best available guy on your board. How do you fight the temptation to trade up? So those are some of the things that we talked about.
We did that Google chat earlier today with that was point guarded by Peter King, and we'll run at some point. I think, am I allowed to say that we did it earlier today, or do they want us to present that like it came out 5 minutes after we put it on.
I don't think it matters. I don't know if the same audience that listens to the podcast is going to read that.
Well, anyway, Daniel Jeremiah, who joined us for that, made a great...
Wait, what is he saying about our listeners? That our listeners don't also read?
Yeah, I'm just saying that people who listen to podcasts are lazy. Like, why not just read a bunch of stuff?
Well, it was good having Robert Klemko on his last podcast.
But fortunately, folks, he's starting his own.
Clemens stuff.
That's Clem with a K. Daniel Jeremiah's point about Ozzie Newsome I found very interesting. You mentioned guys always drafting late in the first round, and Newsome's idea was it doesn't matter about hitting home runs, just don't strike out. Wasn't that what it was?
Hit doubles.
Or how did it go? Do you remember how he worded it? It was really
it was like hit doubles and triples or something, like don't swing for the fences. Something like that. But Ozzy has said some incarnation of that a few times.
And see, now our listeners have to go read this in order to get what we were trying
tease.
To say. Yeah. Yeah.
Andy, that Google Hangout or that Google chat you did wouldn't have been possible without Maryland alum and co-founder of Google, Sergey Brin.
Did you know that, Andy? Did you know that?
Someone hasn't been paying attention to our conversation, Robert.
No,
it's just been Googling around.
I have so been wrapped up in this Maryland alum list. Pretty extensive, dude. The creator of The Wire.
Yeah. Have you ever heard of a little show called Seinfeld, Andy? The guy who created that?
It did quite well. And I know The Wire was pretty impressive, too, for its time. You know what? I tried to watch...
Wait a minute. What do you mean, for its time?
Well, okay. I watched Breaking Bad and had the withdrawals, naturally. I mean, like, my life changed when that show ended. And thought, I'll watch, I got to find a new show now. I've heard The Wire's amazing. I'll dig into that. I found one, and immediately it was apparent I needed to see this before Breaking Bad. Because I can tell it was groundbreaking, but now it all feels just not as good, frankly. I mean, it was before HD really became what it is. And
you were just impressed with Jesse Pinkman's lateral quickness. I think that was what.
Yeah, Jesse Pinkman. Do you have issue with me, Robert, here?
We're getting way out of the realm of our podcast, really, but I think that the show is better appreciated if you have either read before or after the books that David Simon wrote when he retired from writing about crime in Baltimore for the Sun. So he wrote one on a neighborhood and the Depression in it, and he wrote one spending a year with the homicide unit. And if you check out those two, you kind of see The Wire in a whole different light.
Well, as you stated, Robert, our listeners don't read. And so
right.
At the end of every podcast now, Andy gives a movie suggestion.
I was going to do book review.
No, that doesn't benefit.
But I haven't read a full book since the last time we did the podcast. So we'll have Robert's thing that he just said count for that review thing I do.
Oh, perfect.
And I want to ask Robert, before we let him go, on this question. You're in Maryland now. Like, you've been staying in Maryland this whole time, right? You didn't fly to Chicago from Maryland to see the pro day.
No, staying on the East Coast for the foreseeable future.
Oh, really? Okay.
Well, not. I mean, I still have an apartment, but I just for the next month, I'm going to stay out here.
I got you. My question is: have you expensed anything on this Maryland Pro Day article?
Oh, I don't know, man. I don't know if we can really talk about that.
So you have?
Yeah, I've expensed a couple things just because I'm home. Doesn't mean I can't expense stuff, right?
Well, I don't know. Maybe.
Now, after the pro day, I didn't expense anything because that's kind of like my time. You know, I'm not on the road, so to speak.
Yeah.
But if I'm out in College Park, 20 minutes from where I live, I'm on the road.
Okay.
Going back to all the old watering grounds and...
There was really none of that.
No. Okay. All right, Greg. We already had Greg.
We did Greg because then go.
Yeah,
that's how insightful
keep going
Klemko
up and up.
Was.
Yeah.
What are the Greg Bedard podcasts like? Is he very dour?
No, this is Greg Cosell,
not Bedard.
Oh.
Bedard. Come on, he's big.
He came on one time, and I think he learned his lesson. So
he and I got along great. Actually, remember that? It was actually like not the best podcast because we thought we would butt heads over Andrew Luck, and it turns out that Greg thought the same stuff I thought about Luck. He just had a different headline applied to his article by one of our editors.
Creator of the Muppets was also from Maryland.
Yeah, he said Jim.
Oh, did he say Jim?
Yeah,
Jim Henson.
If our editors are listening to this, I want them to know that they're sensationalists. They're yellow journalists.
You've got some real impressive terps, dude. No, I'm serious. You've got some real impressive terps.
All right, thanks, Robert.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
We'll now move on to our breakdown of the NFC South Division, starting with the New Orleans Saints, who have had quite a bit of changes, mostly people leaving on the offensive end. Obviously, Jimmy Graham heading over to the Seattle Seahawks in exchange for Max Unger. What do you think of that move specifically? We've gone into it in detail on the Seahawks end, but we haven't really talked about how the Saints are affected by getting Unger and losing their best playmaker.
Well, their belief is as long as they have Drew Brees, then their system can manufacture its own production. You don't need guys that win in one-on-one or dominate in one-on-one like Jimmy Graham. You got to say something?
No, I was just going to say, and that must be why they keep Marquise Colston. Not going to win in one-on-one.
Yeah, because Colston's not, and it's probably the wrong thing to say win in one-on-one because the system, one-on-one's not bad in the NFL. As Troy Aikman says, if your receiver can't win one-on-one, then you need a new receiver because that's the best you get in the NFL is one-on-one. Colston's a great example, though, a guy that plays in the slot and works the seams. And the Saints are all about operating between the numbers. That's where their passing game lives. And you can dictate matchups between the numbers because that's where the safeties are and that's where the linebackers are. And especially if you get zone coverage, you can really dictate who guards who. And therefore, a very average wide receiver like Marcus Colston, seventh-round type talent, has overachieved, certainly, but an average receiver who doesn't scare anyone, doesn't have great speed, he can be a dominant player in a system like that. So that was the belief, and they realized that, hey, we're producing the same without Jimmy Graham as we did with Jimmy Graham, so let's help two things that have really hurt us over the years. One is the center position itself. Jonathan Goodwin slowed down on them, and then they never found a replacement for him. And so they've had a few years of a drought at the center position. Max Unger fixes that. The second thing, of course, is just the defense in general. And they were able to sign Brandon Browner. That will help. Man, cornerbacks are big for Rob Ryan because he likes to do coverage-based concepts. And the more and he likes to do it with disguises. And the more that he options he has with man-to-man, the more he can do with his disguises in the middle of the field.
Before we completely move on from that offensive side and the Saints, we can wrap up with this. You mentioned that activity in between the numbers with the Saints passing game. How is C.J. Spiller used in that aspect?
Well, Spiller's not – just because it's between the numbers doesn't mean they won't throw the swing pass or the smoke screen. What they do extremely well are just basic running back screens. They're the best screen team in the league. They're not the most diverse, but they're the best old-fashioned screen team. So Spiller gives them that element. I think he will bring diversity to their screens. I mean, what Darren Sproles was to him a few years ago, that's what C.J. Spiller will be to them now. I think he's that kind of a talent for them.
We'll move on to the Atlanta Falcons, one of the more promising offenses on paper. You see the big names, Roddy White, Julio Jones.
I think it's fool's gold. Ryan.
Is it just a tease? Will it ever come together as a real potent offense that can win this division again?
Well, I would say it has come together because this offense was 10 yards away from going to the Super Bowl a few years ago. So it's been a successful group. Not that they're finished. Not that they want to be finished, of course. They would expect 5 more years of this kind of prosperity with Julio Jones and Matt Ryan together. The problem is what they have around them. They need a number 2 receiver to play opposite Jones. Roddy White has seen his best days in their way back in the rearview mirror at this point. I thought he'd be a guy that could maybe hold on like Reggie Wayne style, but what I've learned is that he's having trouble recovering from basic injuries now at this point, which is a sign of old age. So they don't have the receiver to go with him. They haven't replaced Tony Gonzalez yet. Levan Tololo is a number 2 tight end in most people's minds, including, I think, I would imagine, theirs. The other thing I'm concerned about is, well, two other things. Their offensive line still has holes in it. Left guard's a position of issue. Right tackle is a position of issue. And then the new system under Kyle Shanahan, who I think is one of the best offensive coordinators in the league, he did a lot of good stuff for Robert Griffin. Robert Griffin, remember, was, I think he won Rookie of the Year, didn't he?
He did.
Under Shanahan when they were really using his mobility well. Well, it's a rollout-based offense, and they're going to keep that in play. I don't think that's Matt Ryan's strength. I know it's not his strength. Now, it used to be a weakness, and it's no longer a weakness because he was very good on the move last season. That was an element of his game. Atlanta had emphasized that in the offseason. The coaches had said, we want to get big plays out of quarterback mobility. That's one of the 10 most important things to us. And Matt Ryan took that to heart and worked on it and came back as one of the better, I would say, better on the move QBs in the league. That doesn't mean that's still his strength. He's a drop back passer. So I don't know how well the star personnel they have matches up with the system they have. And then the question is, can the system also hide some of the holes that they're going to have trouble filling? Because they're not going to be able to take care of all of these issues in the draft.
Plenty of holes on defense, too. The only real group you look at that isn't totally suffering, maybe cornerback there with Robert Alford and Desmond Trufant. But other than that,
And I'd even disagree about the cornerback because they're not the right style for the scheme that Dan Quinn ultimately wants to run. Dan Quinn comes from Seattle. He's hired because he did a great job with these lanky, physical corners. I think Trufant can work for it because he's an exceptional talent, so he'll work in any system. And he'll probably be best in the slot and nickel packages for him. He'll still start, but where the money downs are, where the obvious passing situations are, I would expect him to play the slot. They've got to find some guys to work on the perimeter, though. I'm not convinced Alford has what they need. I think he's a legit NFL starter, but he's 5'10", 190 pounds at best. That's not a Seahawks style of player.
You mentioned Rob Ryan being dependent a lot on coverage-based schemes. That's Dan Quinn to a T.
It is. And so if you're dependent on coverage schemes, then the other thing you need are pass rushers that can generate their own pressure because he's not going to blitz a whole bunch. Well, this defense was built to be a 3-4, and I'm looking at their defensive line, and you see names. Babineau can probably play in a 4-3 as a defense. In fact, I know he can. He did that for several years before Mike Nolan came to town. But some of the other guys, Tyson Jackson, he's not a 4-3 player. Rashid Hageman, I'm real interested to see what he does.
In year two?
Yeah. I think he can be an excellent nose shade. I don't know if he can be that right away, and he wasn't working nose shade stuff a whole lot last season because that wasn't the scheme they had. And he's a raw player coming into the league last year, and he didn't get a ton of snaps because he remained raw. But that's one concern. Adrian Claiborne is not the dominant number one edge rusher. He's a good number, not that you rank guys, but he's a base defensive end. He's better at taking on the tight end side rather than being your speed off the edge. Corey Berman, I heard at the combine, his agents were saying, well, he'll get 15 sacks a year in Dan Quinn's system.
What?
He has 21 sacks in his 6-year career, I think.
Bad last year.
That's why you don't want to talk to agents. I mean, that's because
an agent's going to say
Of course. And almost none of them, not all of them, but like a lot of them don't know football. Linebackers, their linebacking core's okay. I mean, Brooks Reed, but there's another guy that hasn't played in a 4-3 before. And Justin Durant will be good for him. He'll be solid. Paul Warlew, there's questions about him always because of his size. So we just went through the entire defense, I think, did we not? We didn't talk about the safeties. So maybe they're all right at safety. William Moore, he'll play the Cam Chancellor role. The onus is on Desmond Southward, their third-round pick a year ago. I'm not – this, John, might be a tough year for the Falcons. Tough first year.
Another one.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
When you look at the Tampa Bay Buccaneers too, and now that just after having that conversation, it's an offense with guys that kind of tease you a little bit. Another fool's gold situation here, and then a defense where you're looking for stability.
Well, it's fool's gold because the offensive line is horrible, the worst in the league. All five guys could be upgraded at their spots.
Even Mankins,
yes,
from New England?
Even Mankins at guard. He was not very good last year, not by his standards, certainly. So that's one thing to keep in mind. Remember we talked about with Greg Cosell just a few minutes ago, these deep drop back plays and stretching the field and how you do it and how you block it up, and maybe you don't need – the best lineman because you're in max protection anyway. Well, you can't have glaring weaknesses at any of the line spots still on a 7-step drop, on any play really, but especially these deep dropbacks. Why I say that is because when you have Vincent Jackson and Mike Evans, they want to stretch the field with those guys. Now, the other concern is that takes time. Those guys are great on deep balls because they can elevate and they can win the contested catch, and both of them, tracked the ball in the air extremely well, which is a vastly overlooked attribute for a wide receiver. But neither guy is very fast, and there's an overall lack of speed in this offense, and especially the passing game. So you mix that with a bad offensive line, and I think Jameis Winston, let's assume he's your QB this year, I think he's going to have a tough rookie season because he's going to have to play from the pocket and really throw with bodies around him. And the other thing about Winston is, as Greg pointed out and as we could see just watching ourselves, John, is he has such a wide base when he throws. His stride, as Greg calls it, his stride. So can he throw with bodies around him at the pro level? He'll have to in this system. And Dirk Cutter's going to have his hands full trying to figure out what to do. It's the same problem Cutter had in Atlanta towards the end there. Two good receivers, but how do you get them the ball when you can't block it up for them?
And that's a defense that's really going to struggle too. Looks like the only major acquisition, if you even want to call it that, is Bruce Carter at linebacker being signed out of Dallas.
And that's a good fit schematically, by the way. He played well down the stretch in a similar Tampa 2 style scheme in Dallas. And they're not a true Tampa 2, but for what the linebacker does, the outside linebacker, there's a lot of similar concepts for what Carter did last year in Dallas and what he'll be doing here in Tampa Bay.
Is there anything left to say on Tampa Bay? I mean, when it comes down to it, it's a similar situation as the Falcons. You look at the roster on both sides and go, I just don't see it working.
Well, I mean, we could talk at length about any of these guys and any concepts because we do a football show, but I don't think they're in quite the kind of mess that Atlanta's in. I think Jaquiz Smith showed some signs of life as an edge rusher. Now, no question they need another edge rusher, but maybe they can get one. They're drafting high in the draft, so they'll probably get a good one in the second round. I would expect them to do that. Their linebackers can really run. Lavonte David and Bruce Carter, they only have the two, unless you want to count. I guess Danny Lansana is Lansana, I think. Whatever it is, one of the two. But he's an okay mover as well. But they don't have a lot of depth there. And then the secondary is not great, but you don't need a great secondary when you're playing a cover two scheme.
Looking at the landscape of this division, we've talked about it. Every other show that talks about the NFL has talked about how down the NFC South was last year and that everyone could win it and that three wins might get you a playoff berth. But
three wins.
I'm kidding. But with the Carolina Panthers, are they far and away better than this grouping? Or is it their division to lose, or are they right in that pack too where we really don't know who is going to emerge out of the muck?
If Cam Newton's your quarterback, I don't think you can ever say the teams it's their division to lose, because Newton can lose it for you. He can also win it for you, but there's inherent instability with having Cam Newton as your quarterback because he's inconsistent at this point in his career and will probably remain that way because we've been saying at this point in his career for, 4 years now? So it's that's one concern is what are you going to get out of Newton each week? The other one is also for them, it's wide receivers. There's another team that needs speed over the top. And Kelvin Benjamin's very similar to Mike Evans and Vincent Jackson style-wise. He might ultimately be better than both of them. It'll be interesting to see how Evans and Benjamin. I think we talked about that during the season, didn't we? Which guy will, like, who's the better one to build around?
I think that'll
be fun to track their careers together. But they don't have any speed other than Ted Ginn, who's not a starting wide receiver by any stretch. They don't have any speed to get the ball downfield. And then you wonder a little bit about their offensive line, although they're only weak at one spot, offensive tackle. They signed Michael Orr, but they need to probably upgrade over Nate Chandler. So that's the offense. The defense is fine. The pass rush could use a jolt. But other than that, the defense is fine. And it's similar to Tampa Bay. They're very good at line. Here's the model for playing a Tampa or a cover two type defense, which the Panthers, they're a zone defense as well like that. The model is you have good, smart linebackers. Carolina does. You have a pass rush that can generate its own pressure. They almost do. Coney Ealy, if he can develop, then maybe they do. We've talked about how much they miss Greg Hardy. And then the third part of the model is you don't invest a ton in your secondary because you don't ask a ton of those guys. And if you look at their secondary, it's their Ben Wickery is a fifth-round pick. Trey Boston's a fourth-round pick. Josh Norman, a fifth-round pick.
Roman Harper's a guy with gray hair.
Yeah, he will not be starting this year. They have to draft an upgrade over Harper, someone who can at least run. Even though you don't ask him to do a lot, they do need to run at times. But I mean, we're talking about very low drafted players, and it's not like these are veterans that have risen up. They took Ben Wicker in last season, Boston last season. They've made him starters already. So it's that's the model, and that's what Caroline is doing. And it worked for him 2 years ago. It didn't work for him as much last year, although they still made the play. You know, they got hot down the end, too.
They did,
we forget
yeah.
that, yeah. We forget that.
Next week on the podcast, pass rushers from the 2015 NFL Draft with Greg Cosell, Robert Klemko once again, and we'll get to a breakdown of the NFC West Division. From Andy, I'm John. You can follow me at Ingles Angle or at Andy underscore Benoit for Andy. And remember to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Thanks for listening.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.